On second and 10, he's back to throw. Got a Brits coming in. Screen pass right side. Here comes Chubb. 35, 30, 25, 20. He's going. He's going. He's gone. Nick Chubb is in. Touchdown.
That's the Cleveland Browns scoring their final touchdown to seal a shocking victory and boot the Pittsburgh Steelers out of the playoffs. The NFL's wildcard weekend separated contenders from pretenders, and Bill Barnwell joins the show to explain how it all happened. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Monday, January 11th. This is ESPN Daily. Three, two, one. Bill Barnwell, we are talking at 12:14 a.m. And I don't think you or Browns fans are going to sleep anytime soon.
No, absolutely not.
Bill Barnwell is the host of the Bill Barnwell Show podcast. And by the time you hear this, his NFL column will be found on ESPN Plus. The Cleveland Browns have not only ended their playoff drought, and you not only have a column to write, but the Browns beat the Steelers 48-37, and they did not have their head coach, Kevin Stefanski. They did not have their starting left guard, Joel Bitonio. That was because of COVID on both counts. Mm-hmm. How did the Browns do this, Bill? And maybe the question is better phrased as, what did the Steelers do to themselves here?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of both. I mean, literally on the first snap of the game, you have Pro Bowl center Maurkice Pouncey, probably a future Hall of Famer, snap the ball over the head of Ben Roethlisberger, who, if anything, is tall.
Big! He's big! Big Ben! That's his whole deal!
So, Ben Roethlisberger and running back James Conner both had a chance at falling on the football in the field of play, which would have limited it to a massive loss as opposed to what actually happened, which was the ball squirming away from them and then getting recovered by the Browns in the end zone for the opening touchdown of the game. Roethlisberger threw three interceptions in the first half. One of them bounced off his receiver's hands, and another was the product of a diving grab by 260-pound lineman Porter Gustin, who Pablo, I looked it up. I do not have his high school stats, but I have his college stats. Porter Gustin has not caught a football in the air in a game since at least high school. And he made one of the catches of the season here against Ben Roethlisberger for the third interception of the first half. It was more than a bunch of really bad breaks. The Browns really played well, and the Steelers were really sloppy. They missed a bunch of tackles, really, throughout the entire game against Nick Chubb and Kareem Hunt, the Browns' two-star running backs. They blew a coverage in the end zone, which gave Baker Mayfield basically a practice-level pass to Austin Hooper for an easy touchdown. After the Steelers launched a comeback in the second half, and honestly had me, someone with no rooting interest in this game, nervously pacing around my living room, just solely on behalf of Browns fans, out of the possibility they might lose this game and the psychological trauma that would have been inflicted on them for decades. Thankfully, the Steelers faced a 4th-and-1, and Mike Tomlin decided to punt the ball away, saying he wanted to sustain his team's momentum with field position. Ben Baldwin's 4th-down bot said that reduced the Steelers' chances of winning by more than 7%. And in fact, the Browns moved the ball 80 yards in 6th place for a touchdown and never looked back.
So Ben Roethlisberger ended the night with 4 interceptions in all. He completed 47 of 68. And there was this final humiliation at the very end, Bill, where he was spotted on the bench crying as the NBC camera zoomed in and basically inducted him into the Hall of Memes. I've seen him now with the Curb Your Enthusiasm music, with the Corvette Corvette, Juju Smith-Schuster song superimposed on it. What is happening here now with Big Ben? Is the bell finally tolling for him? He's 38. He's played 17 seasons. Are we going to see an 18th?
So it felt like this was the end for Ben Roethlisberger, right? I mean, you don't typically end up crying on the bench unless you're about to retire. But you look at the math on their salary cap, Pablo. It's pretty clear that was not the plan coming into this season. The Steelers gave Roethlisberger a 2-year, $68 million extension before last year and structured it in such a way to not realize much cap savings if he does retire after 2020. And the Steelers aren't in position because of their cap concerns to take on a Carson Wentz-sized salary at the position. We saw Roethlisberger's limitations this year. He was not the guy of old. Some weeks he looked like he could not throw the ball longer than 10 yards. But the best thing for this organization would be if you were able to return for one final season in 2021.
So in the other AFC game on Sunday, Bill, the Ravens were grappling with quarterback questions of a different kind, because in the days before this game, I was taken aback by how blunt Lamar Jackson was being about his pretty infamous playoff reputation. He admitted that it bothered him, that it had been the number one thing on his mind, that he was, quote, definitely trying to erase that narrative, end quote. And so now he got his first win on Sunday, beating the Titans 20-13. So is the Lamar Jackson playoff narrative officially wiped away? Is it erased finally?
Okay, actually, first off, Pablo, I want to ask you a question. Are we ridiculous about the Lamar Jackson playoff narrative to begin with? I mean, it's not like he's lost five or six games. He's 0-2. He's been a quarterback for three years now. It seems like we're a little too harsh.
Well, he's also like not even 24 or is just about to turn 24. So I was taken aback because he seemed to have internalized it in a way that justified all of our gas bagging, royally speaking, about it.
He's also no longer winless in his career after going down by 10 points at any point during a game. He was 0-6 previously, which the fact that he's only had that happen six times tells you he's really good at getting ahead to leads early in the game. We shouldn't be blaming him for not coming back when they're winning and getting ahead so early frequently in games. Now, Peyton Manning early in his career was the classic example of this. If Lamar Jackson loses to the Bills next week, there will be people who come out and suggest, oh, well, Lamar Jackson won a playoff game, but he can't beat a great quarterback. He can't win the quote unquote big one. We see this happen where once you lose two or three games in the playoffs at the start of your career, you get in this endless game of moving the goalposts, and every previous bar that you hit gets ignored until realistically you win two Super Bowls. Because even with Peyton, there was a situation where he won one and people said, oh, he got lucky. It was a fluke. He's lost so many other times. He had to win a second one to really get people off of his back. So I think Lamar Jackson has to win two Super Bowls now, which is incredibly unfair and incredibly unrealistic. The good news is Lamar Jackson took his first step on that path towards overcoming that unfair reputation with a win on Sunday.
Now, on the losing side of this, Bill, it was remarkable how invisible Derrick Henry was all game. He finished with just 40 yards rushing after running for more than 2,000 in the regular season. So how did Baltimore neutralize Derrick Henry in this game?
Well, it's simple, Pablo. The best way to stop Derrick Henry is to do it with a friend. The Ravens loaded up the box with bodies and forced Henry to try and run through multiple tacklers on just about every one of his 18 rushing attempts on Sunday. I think, really, in a way, this goes back to what happened for the Ravens last year when they lost Tennessee in the divisional round. Derrick Henry ran all over them, and the Ravens really upgraded this offseason along their defensive front. They brought in Calais Campbell from Jacksonville. They traded for Yannick Ngakoue. They signed Derek Wolfe. They added all these pieces who are solid run defenders who can hold up on the edge and take away Tennessee's outside zone-based running game. And on Sunday, we saw them do the best job we've seen from anybody this year when it comes to stopping Henry. He had zero first downs in the running game for the first time since Ryan Tannehill took over last year. And of course, Pablo, Mike Vrabel surprisingly helped the Baltimore cause. This is the same man who not only signed Henry to a massive deal this offseason, but famously suggested he would cut off a vital organ if it meant that the Titans would win a Super Bowl. Mike Vrabel chickened out, Pablo, with the season on the line. There's no other way to put it. Tennessee was facing a 4th-and-2 on the Baltimore 40-yard line with 10 minutes to go in the fourth quarter of a one-score game, and they decided to punt. And Pablo, Twitter exploded. Ex-players were mad. Analytics nerds were mad. You can never get everyone on Twitter to agree on something. And yet everyone agreed this punt sucked. It was a bad idea. The Ravens picked up the yardage from the punt in 4 plays and never looked to be in danger of losing the rest of the way.
On one end of the approval matrix would be that punt. On the other end would be the Nickelodeon broadcast of the Saints-Bears game. And yes, the Saints won, the Bears lost.
Breeze, hand it off, Kamara plunging forward, end zone and touchdown.
Hey, there's the slug! Beep, beep, beep!
Beep, beep, beep! Hey, hey!
I watched that Nickelodeon broadcast. I watched the slime, I watched the SpongeBob, the kid-friendly explainers, the only one uncensored F-bomb.
That's impressive. They only managed one. on the Nickelodeon podcast. Good for them.
I was blown away. Why did this work so well?
It was a hit. I mean, Twitter loved it. I loved it. And I think it was a hit because it gets to the core of one of the problems with watching football, or the differences between watching football and the act of seeing it on television, which is the broadcast really isn't very fun, or isn't as fun often as it should be. Football is fun, and it's often very stupid with very dumb things happening. And the Nickelodeon broadcast treated it that way. Nick Nation also, by the way, gave Mitch Trubisky the MVP award and then had his graphic getting slimed as they announced the honor, which is probably, to be fair, about the way Bears felt after he had another playoff loss.
It was perfect. Just the idea that Mitch Trubisky would win the MVP despite all of it, which raises the follow-up question of, like, what happens here? Because the Bears have Mitch Trubisky, they have Matt Nagy, their head coach. They have a playoff berth, but also a loss like this after a season that was just 8-8. Like, are their fates connected? Do they stay in Chicago? What happens to them?
I also have to report, Pablo, that there has been a battle all day and all night since that game on Wikipedia of people adding the MVP award to Mitch Trubisky's career highlights and awards section, and then having it removed shortly thereafter.
How dare those tyrannical censors at Wikipedia behave this way?
As for Trubisky's future, I think it's really up in the air, right? I mean, Trubisky had a late season run, which was pretty impressive. It inspired talk of a new contract, but as we discussed on this very show, it came against some of the worst defenses in football. Mm. The Saints are not one of the worst defenses in football. They're one of the best. And to be fair, Trubisky should have had a long touchdown pass early in the game on a trick play where he delivered a perfect throw downfield, and Javon Wims just dropped the pass.
And a direct snap out of the pistol. They hand it off now on the flea flicker from Patterson to Trubisky, and Wims dropped the touchdown over the back. It was right there.
The problem for the Bears now is that they don't have many options. Nick Foles is under contract for 2021, but the Bears are projected to be narrowly over the cap right now before they even add another quarterback to replace Trubisky, who's a free agent, or re-sign Allen Robinson, who's also an unrestricted free agent next year. They aren't going to have a lot of money to go after a replacement at quarterback. They don't really have the draft capital saved up to trade up and grab a quarterback somewhere in the top 10. What happens with this coaching staff in the front office may end up determining what happens with Chicago. If Nagy or general manager Ryan Pace leave, or if they both leave, the Bears may be more inclined to blow things up and start over with a new quarterback competing with Foles. If the brain trust comes back, though, wouldn't it be shocking if Trubisky joined them for one final go-around in Chicago.
All right, Bill, up next, I want to move on from the MVP and talk to you about Saturday's wild card games. And I want to start with the nail-biting, table-smashing Buffalo Bills.
When you're on a business trip, you know what completely goes off the rails? Your workout routine, especially when you book a hotel that doesn't have a gym. So what ends up happening is you do a few push-ups and sit-ups in your room, run around the block, or just skip it entirely. Lame. If you just stay at La Quinta by Wyndham, you'll discover there's a fully equipped fitness center at every location. Now you can wake up and power your buys and tries the right way, or de-stress with some cardio. The choice is yours. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
So, Bill, I want to start with the early game here on Saturday because, look, the Buffalo Bills won their first playoff game since 1995, and this is historic. It is enormous. I am so happy for our Bills fans, friends, including our producer, Aaron Vail. But it came against Philip Rivers, who for the 9 millionth time, I believe, found himself driving down the field, very end of the game, with a chance to win. And his Hail Mary falls short.
Rivers backs the throw. Going to heave it way downfield on a Hail Mary around the goal line. And it's batted down at the 5 by Buffalo. And that is Micah Hyde breaking it up. And the Buffalo Bills have won their first playoff game since 1995.
And so now I have all these questions about Buffalo because I didn't expect this to be a 3-point game, given how dominant Josh Allen and his Bills have looked since Thanksgiving, basically. Mm-hmm. So what did you see from Buffalo in this game?
I saw a team that looked vulnerable outside of their superstar MVP candidate quarterback. I mean, this felt like a coronation game for Josh Allen, right? He was awesome. He was responsible for 378 yards and 3 touchdowns across his work as a passer and a runner. Didn't turn the ball over. The rest of the team, not so much. Buffalo's pass defense was ripped apart for most of the day by Rivers, who it seemed like every third down he managed to find an open receiver for a first down. Late in that first half, it took a stop at the last possible second, some spectacular catches by Gabriel Davis, and a successful hard count on a fourth down to get the Bills in the lead at the end of the first half. Buffalo really won this game because they were perfect in the red zone and hit both of their field goals. That's a tough formula to sustain. It relies on Allen to be near perfect. If he's just good, the Bills lose this game.
But Bill, I want to point this out too, because critics of Colts head coach Frank Reich, and there were many of them on Saturday, they would argue that the Bills also got away with it because of the play calling from the Colts and this alleged over-reliance on, yes, analytics. Because in the second quarter, Bill, the Colts go for it on fourth down and they fail instead of kicking a field goal, what obviously turns out to be a 3-point game. And then at another point, the Colts go for two and fail. So how irresponsible to you did these more controversial play calls feel?
Analytics. Such a mess. I will say this much. Maybe I don't know much about analytics, but most of Frank Reich's controversial decisions in this game, Pablo, would be considered either analytically friendly or within the margin of error when it came to his decisions. The Colts went for it on fourth and goal, like you said, from the 4-yard line at the end of the first half. And they did fail to score, it's true. But throw aside the numbers, Phillip Rivers had an open receiver in the end zone and the ball hit him in the hands. Yes. Like, that's good. You want to call a play on fourth down where you have an open receiver waiting to catch a touchdown pass in the end zone. You just have to execute. Later in the game, the Colts scored a touchdown down 14, and the Bills went offsides on the ensuing extra point try, which led Reich to try a 2-point attempt from the 1-yard line. The numbers also favor this move. I know it doesn't sound particularly intuitive, but your chances of converting at least 1 2-pointer are better than your chances of failing on 2 2-pointers, especially from the 1-yard line. If you succeed on that first 2-pointer, Pablo, you can win the game with an extra point on the next score. Pablo, throw the numbers aside. Let's just get to the basic tenet here, which is that most coaching arguments and or commentator-led analysis of analytics are built around extending the game for as long as possible and not losing. Frank Reich's decisions and a lot of the analytics problems which pop up are about trying to maximize your team's chances of winning, not losing. It's true that if the Colts had gone for a field goal at the end of the first half and nothing else changed over the course of the entire game, the game would have been tied on that final drive, and the game would have gone into overtime if the Colts had failed. Now, at the same time, Pablo, it's also true that if they had just converted on that one play from the 4-yard line, where, again, an open receiver was hit in the hands with the football, and nothing else changed afterwards by that same standard, the Colts would have won the game without having to go to overtime as underdogs against an extremely hot and effective offense. You can take issue with some of Indy's play calling and short yardage, but Reich's decisions were not wrong. He did not cost the Colts this game.
So over in the NFC, Bill, there was also this all-around instability under center. And I want to get to what the Rams were dealing with the quarterback in a minute, and it was a lot. But first, I have real questions about the quarterback the Rams beat on Saturday, our old friend Russell Wilson. What exactly happened to him and Seattle, Bill? And like, if this game was a dish, how would you describe what Russ ended up cooking?
I would say it would be like a slop, but the sort of slop that you would be very disappointed. Like, not even a good slop, like a really, really upsetting slop. It was, as far as Russell Wilson goes, this was, by QBR, his 5th worst game as a pro over the course of the last decade or so. Not even look for 5th worst playoff game. This is a guy who once threw 4 interceptions in a playoff game and won. I mean, this was a absolutely awful performance from Russell Wilson. And there were so many problems with the Seahawks in this game. It's not just one kind of slop, Pablo. Several slops mixed together over the course of this three-hour period. The Rams were able to sack Wilson 5 times on 27 dropbacks, despite losing Aaron Donald, who is pretty good. For most of the second half, they pressured Wilson on 50% of his dropbacks, his highest single game rate this season, and one of the highest rates for any quarterback in a game this year. And as the game wore on, frankly, despite the fact that Russell Wilson is a veteran quarterback and was an MVP candidate for most of this year, he was frazzled. Wilson threw one interception and could have thrown 2 more if the Rams had held on to the football. Even on the plays where he wasn't pressured on Sunday, Wilson posted a QBR of 4 out of 100. 4, the second worst performance for any quarterback in any game this year when they were not pressured. Right up there with the Sam Darnolds and the Brandon Allens of the world. That's not where Russell Wilson belongs.
So as for the Rams now, Bill, Jared Goff, their starting quarterback, he entered Saturday healing from this thumb fracture on his throwing hand, and so Sean McVay started his backup, John Wolford, who wound up getting knocked out of Saturday's game and into an ambulance, sending Goff onto the field. And so now I am wondering why, Bill, if Goff could play this whole time, they went with Wolford in the first place, and how the Rams like pulled this whole win off given those circumstances at all.
It's interesting, right? It does seem curious. Something doesn't seem to add up with what Sean McVay's decision suggested, because even before a ball was snapped on Saturday, the Rams had 2 quarterbacks on their active roster, John Wolford and Jared Goff. That means Goff was healthy enough to play if Wolford struggled or got injured, which of course is what happened. But the Rams still thought they were better with Wolford as their starting quarterback. Something just doesn't make sense there, because if Goff wasn't healthy enough to start, it would seem likely that the Rams would have promoted Blake Bortles to the active roster. Wolford suffered a neck injury scrambling in the first half and gave way to Goff, who was inconsistent. He was very tough. He played through a injury that was surely painful. He was 9-19 for 155 yards and a touchdown pass to seal up the game in the fourth quarter.
Goff lost the ball, left side, caught the 5. Robert Woods walks in and launches it into the stands in celebration. Touchdown LA, and the Rams are advancing.
Goff's biggest play was a 44-yard completion to Cooper Kupp on a pass that was, let's be honest, horribly underthrown. Only for Cooper Kupp to outjump another injured player in Jamal Adams to bring in a spectacular catch. Goff didn't seem confident with the ball in his hands. Rams really won this game more with their running game and Cam Akers and a dominant defensive performance, more so than what Goff did with the ball in his hands as a passer.
So I now need to ask you about the guy who ended up at quarterback for the Washington football team, Taylor Heinicke, because look, this loss to Tom Brady and the Bucs was surprisingly close. It was ultimately an 8-point loss, thanks to Heinicke. And this dude was apparently taking online courses in partial differential equations when he became Washington's quarantine practice squad quarterback last month. And now, Bill, he is possibly suddenly a lot more than that. So what did you see from him?
Yes, he's the first quarterback to have a opportunity to play because of Kendall Hinton and the Broncos. So the gift that keeps on giving, that Kendall Hinton game for Denver. He's about as anonymous, really, as a starting quarterback around the NFL can be. This is a guy who was an Old Dominion product. He started his career on the Minnesota practice squad under the stewardship of Scott Turner, who is now the Washington offensive coordinator. So always good to know people when you're starting out in a career. Heinicke's undersized, and I think that limited the interest in him coming out of school. He's bounced around 5 different practice squads and thrown passes for the Texans and the Panthers before taking some Week 16 snaps for Washington as their 4th quarterback of the season. His athleticism and his ability to extend plays with his legs gave the Bucs problems, and Heinicke showed he had the arm strength to make throws all over the field, even on the run. He threw for 306 yards and added 46 more on the ground, including that diving rushing touchdown in the 3rd quarter.
Heinicke, 3rd and 5 at the 8. Pocket collapses. He ducks his head, somehow gets out of it, is running to the left side, to the 5, diving for the end zone. Is he in? Waiting for a goal. Touchdown! Oh. Touchdown, Washington!
We saw enough from him to suggest he has a future in this league as a quarterback, and that he can probably put the partial differential equations Coursera course to the side for now. I don't think he's earned enough to have a clear path to a starting job, but I think he's going to get some guaranteed money, probably from Washington. And it wouldn't be a surprise to see him have an opportunity to start at some point in 2021.
So back to Tom Brady here at the end, because Brady was able to beat Washington, walk away with his first playoff win with the Bucs, the 31st, the most ever of his career. How was he able to get this done?
He was able to take advantage of a missing part of this Washington football team that was kind of the part we were expecting to be the difference maker if this game was close, and that was the defensive line. I mean, this game plan was supposed to be really that they were home underdogs. There was going to be a muddy field, bad weather, and a great pass rush pressuring Tom Brady. I mean, the numbers are not subtle here when it comes to Tom Brady's performance with and without pressure this year. When he has not been pressured, he has the fifth best QBR in football, kind of where you'd expect Tom Brady to be. When he is pressured, he's tied for Nick Mullins for 31st in QBR. Tom Brady should not be tied with Nick Mullins for anything. So the story was simple. Get pressure on Tom Brady, you've got a shot. Jack Del Rio's defense just didn't get home frequently enough to bother Brady. It's a shame because the concern coming into this game is that the rest of the Washington football team might not do enough to keep up with Chase Young and that impressive defensive line. Instead, they got the sort of performance they would have needed from their offense to pull an upset, but the defensive line wasn't able to do enough to consistently impact the game.
Bill Barnwell, thank you for consistently giving us the impactful performance that we need on ESPN Daily.
It's a team effort, Pablo. Thank you.
All right, up next, I want to call up Andrea Adelson, who is down in Florida for Monday's college football championship.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured, it was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo, another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky, 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
Here's another story I want you to know. The college football playoff national championship kicks off tonight with number one Alabama taking on number three Ohio State after a truly abnormal college football season. Andrea Adelson is in Miami to cover the game in person, so I asked her to set the scene for us.
So Miami feels like a city where COVID does not exist, interestingly. I was out in Miami Beach earlier doing some interviews, and there were people crowded around outside enjoying a lovely day here in Miami with the temperature. It was probably about 72 degrees. I'm the only ESPN.com reporter in Miami, and usually we have about a crew of six here. So that's just one tiny little small window into how different things are this year.
So Andrea, how is this work for you going to be different at the game given all of these circumstances?
Well, one of the best things about going to a playoff semifinal or the national championship game is the access that we have. We're allowed to be on the field a couple of hours before kickoff. And then afterward, we're allowed into the locker room. It's the only time in college football where you're allowed access to players in a locker room setting. We don't have any of that this year. There is no pregame field access. There is no postgame locker room access. So this year, I'll be watching from the press box with a mask on, and the postgame interviews will be happening over Zoom. But nonetheless, the fact that we have gotten to this point is a victory, and I am just excited. I get to be there to witness it and to document it.
So there were questions, too, to zoom out for a second here, as recently as last week, Andrea, about whether this game would even be happening as scheduled on account of COVID concerns with Ohio State in particular. So where are we with that right now? How would you describe the lead up to get to this final Monday? What's it taken to get here?
It has been a zigzagging, upside down roller coaster with stops and starts and stops and starts again. So to even get to this point, I think a lot of people in college football would probably call it miraculous, because there was a time in late summer, early August, that people thought there would not be a season. And as for the lead up to this game, Ohio State has been dealing with COVID issues for about 6 weeks now. So it's not super surprising that there continue to be some issues, or that there was even discussion about whether this game could be played on time. So it was not super surprising to see that, but both teams are here. Ryan Day and Nick Saban met with the media on Sunday via Zoom. They are ready to play. The only question is who will be missing for Ohio State.
I should point out here too, Andrea, that there were other medical concerns on top of the virus in Ohio State's most recent game. I mean, we just saw Justin Fields, their star quarterback, play the game of his life, throw 6 touchdowns to upset Clemson, but he was also really injured, it seemed, in the rib area. What do we know about Fields and his health right now?
We don't know much other than he's going to play on Monday night. And Ohio State has kept it really close to the vest. We talked to Justin Fields also via Zoom a few days ago, and all he would say was, "I'm good to go Monday night."
What do you think we should expect to see, Andrea, given this context, given all of this chaos from this game itself?
I hope we get a good game. That's what I think everybody's hoping for, especially after going through the semifinals, which were 2 blowouts and not really super interesting. So for Ohio State, the questions are, you have geared everything toward this moment. How are you going to handle it? How are you going to react? Are we going to see the Ohio State that we saw against Clemson? Or are we going to see the Ohio State we saw against Northwestern in the Big Ten championship game, which was not a very good Ohio State performance? For Alabama, we have seen Alabama put together their best effort week after week after week. So for me, it's all about whether Ohio State can control the line of scrimmage, whether they can limit Alabama's possessions, and whether Justin Fields and the offense can score to keep up with what Alabama is going to be capable of doing in this game. I will never forget speaking to Ohio State center Josh Myers after the Big Ten made the decision in August that they were not going to start the season on time. He was near tears when he talked about potentially losing an opportunity to play for a national championship. He was adamant that Ohio State and its players wanted to play because they felt as if they had the team to be able to do it. Whatever happens on Monday night, the fact that they got this opportunity is something that all of them have spoken so highly about, because they didn't even think they would get it. It's almost as if there's a greater appreciation for being here right now because they were able to make it this far after a season was nearly taken away from them.
Andrea Adelson, it has been a roller coaster ride of a season. Thank you for previewing what the final loop-de-loop here might look like on ESPN Daily.
As long as everyone's got their hands up at the end screaming that we made it, it'll be a good ride.
I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.